when Schultz and Biden had a news conference, at which time Biden said, "Well, if they bomb, if they go in, we'll destroy them." And Schultz said nothing. It does not make sense for the German chancellor to have willingly agreed. Mm-hmm. He's complicit in that. And that's bad. He shouldn't be doing that. That's not his business. His business is protecting the people of Germany. I'm sorry. I've been doing this for a long time. And that stinks. It doesn't make sense.
Ich bin super stolz und glücklich, euch exklusiv den legendären Journalisten und Pulitzer-Preisgewinner Simon Hirsch erstmalig auf einem deutschsprachigen Kanal zu präsentieren. Simon Hirsch hat vor einigen Wochen für Aufsehen gesorgt, weil er Insiderquellen in seinem Artikel genannt hat, die behaupten, dass die Anschläge auf die Nord Stream Pipelines von den Amerikanern gemeinsam mit den Norwegern durchgeführt worden sind. Vor einigen Tagen gab es dann eine andere These, die behauptet hat, es waren pro-ukrainische Kräfte mit einer Yacht. Und daraufhin hat er vor einigen Tagen eine Replik veröffentlicht mit dem Namen Cover-Up. Über all diese Themen sprechen wir heute exklusiv in einer neuen spannenden Folge. Marc spricht mit Simon Hirsch. Mr. Hirsch, it's an honor having you on my channel.
Oh, I'm happy, happy. I like to yak.
Perfect. Just a little introduction to our audience. You're very famous, of course, and you just published 2 Substack articles about the Nord Stream sabotage or attack. Just yesterday, you published a second article about the cover-up of the attack, of course. So before we talk about this, according to your source, who blew up the Nord Stream pipeline, and most importantly, why?
Well, what I wrote was that, of course, Joe Biden made the call. And what I said in the initial article, there was a long-standing operation that had all of this had its beginnings about 3 months before Russia attacked in the Ukraine, when they were building up. And it was very clear there was great enmity, a lot of nasty exchanges between Biden and his foreign policy team and the Russians. And so there was not a happy medium, and no serious talks and negotiation. And so the White House, under the National Security Advisors, a gentleman named Jake Sullivan, convened the meeting before Christmas in 2021. This is we're talking about before the war. And the idea was the White House wanted to call in the usual group of specialists of the CIA, and from our, we have a listening company, the National Security Agency, which all of these, our intelligence works closely with your people, as you know, forever, very closely, very good relationship.
Yeah.
And the National Security Council was involved, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Secretary of State, the usual. And they began a series of very secret meetings. And the question being asked, and the language I used the language that actually was asked, which if I'd been in the White House should have convinced them there was somebody who knew something was talking to me. The question was, they asked, we want to do something to convince Putin not to attack. And we want options that are reversible or irreversible. A reversible option would be sanctions, like we did, closing McDonald's and forcing companies out.
Yeah,
and we see some German money that was in banks abroad, a lot of money, many billions, and stop buying oil. And the irreversible stuff was something kinetic. And that became the option. We can blow up a pipeline if we have to. And you have to understand there's been a long American history in the Cold War in terms of our notion that evolved of containment of communism. The first time it became public, I wrote about this also in one of the pieces I did for the Substack, was in the Kennedy days. The worry was that Russia had tremendous amounts of gas and methane gas, clean gas, and oil that they were selling directly to Germany via pipelines. And that always worried us. We always viewed from the Kennedy days on, the Russians were weaponizing their gas to get leverage and as communists in a world that we wanted to be non-communist, Western Europe, after World War II. And particularly complicated for Germany, because your country, of course, having been in the war and done a lot of damage to Europe, had a lot of enemies. And I think Willy Brandt deserves more credit than he gets for the idea of Ostpolitik, which is we're going to show our neighbors we are different. We're energetic. We have great industrial capability. We're going to be doing trading. We're going to be turning into a great power, and we're going to be good partners of Europe, which they were. And that's how they got back. I mean, trading and using cheap Russian energy. And so by the time Nord Stream 1, which was the first pipeline that was sponsored by gas, it was run by oligarchs, Russian oligarchs, 51%. It was a major pipeline that produced zillions, billions and billions of feet of gas as a wonderful measurement. I can't remember how much they moved to Germany. Nord Stream 1 was a pipeline that made a great deal of money for four European companies that owned 49% of it. And the rest was owned by oligarchs. A lot of money flowed back to Russia too, of course, from it to Putin's office, not necessarily to him personally, to the treasury. And so Nord Stream 1 from 2011 on was an engine. Your country prospered, your automobile, you're a great manufacturing company, BASF, the largest chemical company, were incredibly competent and very serious industrial country, probably an outstanding country in terms of in Western Europe. A lot of, and so we always worried about that. That the tie with Russia over energy. So a second pipeline was built and was constructed, finished by 2021. We're talking about $1 billion, many billions spent, 750 miles from a distributing point in very near Leningrad, all the way along the Baltic Sea to Germany, no stops, yeah. Unlike the other pipelines. And so when that first one came, we were already in a war of words with Putin about Ukraine, about there was going to be a war pretty clearly. And so your chancellor, I think under pressure, I know at our request or pushing, sanctioned the second pipeline. It was left standing with 750 miles of gas in it. That's what blew up. And so at a certain point, I wrote about the CIA with NSA, with signals people and others, went to Norway. We've had a longstanding relationship with the Norwegian Navy and Norway in particular. Norway has 1,400 miles of coastline from Oslo all the way to the Arctic Circle where Russia is. And we have built and helped finance radar stations. We rebuilt a submarine base, a Navy base. We put hundreds of millions, if not billions, into monitoring Russia from the Arctic Circle with the help of the Norwegians, and who don't like Russia any more than we do. And so they helped us. I wrote about this in the initial article. We worked with them very closely, as we have since the Vietnam War days and before that. We worked very closely with Russia during World War II, of course. I mean, with Norway in various operations. And so they did it. They found a way to blow up the pipeline. The president didn't want it. He delayed doing it. It was left. They were going to do it during a military exercise in late May, early June. He said no. He was afraid of it then, Biden, because it would look too much like us. So 3 months later, he wanted it done. And by that time, the mines were there. All you needed to do was fly over, drop a sonar device, and it has a knock-knock signal.
Yeah,
you can't use high frequency in water. It burns up, but low frequency could works. And so 3 months later, he did it. It blew up. Why then? I don't have a perfect answer. I know then by then, I spent a lot of time wondering why then, why in late September? Well, one thing is by that time, it was pretty clear there was no going to be a Ukraine victory, as some people thought. In fact, I think the coverage from the West, my old newspaper, I worked for the New York Times for many years, 8 years. Wrote 800 stories for them, maybe five with a named source, always unnamed, always about CIA. I wasn't a friend of the CIA's. I was writing about their operations against American citizens, operations against Salvador Allende, et cetera, et cetera. I wasn't their friend. And so, I mean, you can't write naming people. You're dead. You know that, any journalist knows. But that's a big issue when you don't want a story. And so the best guess I could make on that question, And by then it was clear there was going to be a stalemate at best in the war. And if you remember, I don't know why people don't pay more attention to this. Putin only put about 120,000 troops into a war against a country with a huge army, 44 million people in it, a major army that had been supported and built up by NATO in the last 10 years anyway. When the Wehrmacht went into Poland in 1939, probably the best army there was in history, it was 1.2 million people. You're not going to do it. So his ambitions were much less in the beginning, according to my friends. And the people I know in the intelligence community here and in other countries have always been very skeptical about the possibility of Ukraine winning. We'll see. At best, you're going to get a stalemate. I think at that point, Joe Biden had bet everything on Ukraine. Renomination, re-election, the public supported it initially. Right now, America has put $120 billion into the war, and the tides are turning politically. The last poll I showed was more than 60% against it. In the beginning, everybody said, let's speed up. We hate Russia. We hate Putin. Let's beat up Putin. But now that the worm is turning, he's got a political problem now.
Yeah.
Because no question. So he decided he was worried that that Scholz and others in Germany would rather opt to be warm and keep the industry going than put a lot more money into what could be a losing venture. You know, we finally convinced Germany to produce some tanks that are eventually going to go in. We put a lot of pressure on Germany. Your country is not interested in being a major military force now. That's just a fact. And yeah. There's a lot of political, you know, that's a constant conversation there.
Yeah.
And you have your own problems. Immigration, you have tremendous political problems in Germany, obviously. And so I think Joe took the option away from Chancellor Scholz. There's also a reason to think that maybe Chancellor Scholz, I also hear this too, that maybe he agreed in the end. This was going to be always a political nightmare with the Americans. As long as there was a pipeline that the Russians were supplying the gas for, they're always going to have some leverage. I don't know. All I know is at this point, one cannot separate Scholz from the notion of blowing up the pipeline. He may not have known initially. But once it happened and he's playing the game, he's keeping it very quietly. You know, there was this crazy story the other week, just the other day, that in America and Germany, that there was some yacht they found that did it. I mean, you know, that didn't go far because it's so patently insane. You can't dive 260 feet off a yacht. Mm. And not only that, the only way the government found it is they tracked it. And the yacht that was there to blow up the mine, they tracked it in the area. Obviously had his IFF, AIS signals. It, you know, they would, and a yacht has to have it if they're going to go into ocean waters. They have to be able to have a call signal, know where they are. So the story even says that the yacht involved that was doing it was kept on being signaled, had the signal so they could track it. It makes no sense. But anyway, that's another story. It's not making much traction. So I think we did it to keep him from having an option that we didn't want him to have. Mm-hmm. In other words, what Joe Biden was telling Western Europe, because a lot of the gas that Germany was getting from the first pipeline was more than they needed it. And they were retailing, we call it the downstream. Germany was able to sell some of the gas that it had, excess gas, to other businesses and companies in Europe. I mean, making profit out of, about which the Russians didn't care. It was that much gas. And so there you are. There's other supplies, but there's, I quoted an expert on, who's an editor of a gas journal here, a very privately industrial journal, not for newsstands. You have to subscribe and you have to be a bank or a lawyer or an oil company to get it. And a wonderful woman named Sarah Miller, 30 years as editor, and she was describing to me the economic troubles you're going to have. You're having already. Yeah. If you don't know how much you had a mild winter, and you were able between September and winter to build up LNG, liquefied natural gas. I mean, you know, very creatively. And also, your government spent an incredible amount of money subsidizing gas for the people, the citizens, last winter. It got cold. And funny, after New Year's, it got cold. There were some bad stretches. And I know from friends, people were really irritated in Berlin about not being able to keep the house at 70 degrees. And the Bundestag was at 60, I understand. People were wearing pajamas or ski clothes underneath their regular outfit in the parliament. So there you are. So what Joe Biden said to Germany, well, since you won't, you know, you can't make a commitment to support me forever in this war I'm going to lose, I'm going to keep you away from deciding to take gas. It's not, if you have a bad winter this year, you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah.
If you're a big company and you want to build a major project somewhere, in you know, one of the major industries, you can't predict what the cost of gas is going to be next year. You can't subsidize it as much as your government did. You're a very big government. You had a lot of money to subsidize. That's not going to happen. You don't have the reserves you had last year.
Yeah. So your first article was a bombshell. It was actually a scandal and everybody was talking about. Were you surprised about the response, about the feedback, about the backlash which came because people called you like names and conspiracy theorist and now he gets old and grumpy and he's out of his mind?
I'm definitely old and grumpy, I'll tell you that. you know, I play a lot of tennis and don't hit a drop shot to me because I won't chase it. Anyway, but no, the thing that got me going in terms of being somebody of importance was I did a story about a major massacre in Vietnam.
Yeah, 1969.
What it said to the American people, and they did not want to hear this, is that we fight wars no better than anybody else.
Yeah.
And I'd been in the U.S. Army. As a kid, I was drafted. You had to go in and be drafted. Now it's a volunteer army. You go in, but then you were drafted. And I learned how to shoot a gun. I learned how to do all that stuff. And I would have gone with my fellows anywhere. Because you don't fight for the flag, you fight for the people in your unit. So I understood how you can get into the war, but I could never understand how you could rape and murder 500 people. And it was a horrible story, and that got me going. I ended up working, I was a wire service for the Associated Press. I ended up working for the New York Times, and then for a wonderful magazine, The New Yorker, and written 11 books. Some of them I made a lot of money on, and some which I did not. That's the way it is. But I'm there. And so I understand the easy way to deal with a problem is to say anonymous sources. I will tell you this about it. That first story, there's not one place where a source is in a meeting. Because I understand how you research, how you find the people. If I have anybody in a meeting, they know who's there. Anyway. And so I'm sorry about my phone. I thought I turned it off, but I did not.
No problem.
Anyway, big deal. So there you are. It's getting traction in a lot of people in the Bundestag have called me, but I don't do anything politically. I don't deal with in America. I've had a few people, some prominent people here, but I just don't do politics. I've never testified to Congress. I just write my stories and I'm not a political player. There was a lot about Joe Biden. The domestic programs were good. I don't understand why Joe Biden and the people around him, his Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, is very anti-communist, but he was supposed to go meet his counterpart in Beijing 3 weeks ago, and he didn't go because of a balloon? You know what I mean? I mean, are you kidding me? What's this about? And the hostility. And the hostility about the meeting between Xi and Russia. And we have a problem with Zelensky that nobody wants to talk about that. Maybe I'll write about it. I don't know. I don't like to do this, but corruption there is terrific in Ukraine, much more than we're telling anybody.
It was the most corrupt country in the world a couple of years ago. Everybody knew it.
Oh, you couldn't go there as a businessman without having $25,000 in cash just so you can get through the airport, basically. The problem is that it hasn't stopped. A lot of the weapons that we send them don't get to where they're going. And the coverage, since America hates, we found a new person to hate after all the people in the world we've hated. You know, now Putin's number one on the list. But I'll tell you something. I've been reading his speeches carefully. Yes, he's a man of magic thinking. You know, the old Germany is very much in his soul. He doesn't want the old socialist republic again. He doesn't want to come. He doesn't want Western Europe. He doesn't want to go to Berlin. He wants Ukraine to be a buffer. And he's willing to have, my understanding is, I think the critical thing for us to understand in America is that the one demand that I don't think he's going to back off on is demilitarization of Ukraine.
Yeah.
And he can let the government stand. He wants them neutral and neutered. Three centuries ago, two centuries ago, the Russians were like creatures from the outer sea. Ukraine had nobility, had It was a much more progressive and socially elite place than Germany. Now, sort of, so the Germans have this image, two images, one of a Ukraine that was always superior to them in terms of they were very royal, they had an upper class, they were very educated. And the other one is as people they want to keep down. They want them to be serfs. If you remember, Stalin in 1930, when there was a famine, took all the grain from Ukraine and 22 million Ukrainians starved to death. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And he's not going to let go. And even the former ambassador to Berlin, to Germany, Bill Burns, who's now the CIA chief, in a memoir he wrote after retiring, he was 20 years or 30 years as a diplomat, including Deputy Secretary of State. He warned in a memoir he wrote 6-7 years ago after leaving, after retiring, that Russia will go to war with Ukraine if we keep on expanding NATO to the east. This is an old story. Everybody knows it. But the guy running the CIA who ran this mission that bombed the shell, that just shows you how the worm turns, they say. It's always where you're sitting. But I didn't give you a chance to write or ask a question. Ask a question.
So were you disappointed that your old colleagues at the New York Times, for example, called you like a conspiracy theorist?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That happened in the Obama administration. Obama was not Putin. And he was not George Bush and Dick Cheney, you know, choosing to go to war against Iraq because some Saudi Sunni nutcakes blew up 9/11. So the answer was to go to Iraq, a completely irrational decision that probably as worse as we made, period, in the last really an insane decision. So Obama gets in and there was a love affair. And so I just... When he had bin Laden killed, he certainly did authorize it, and that's a plus. I mean, that's you might want to have captured him, but everything he did after that was a lie, and the American press loved Obama and loved the stories. There were stories. I know the White House would they give a telephone number to call in on. And then you call on, and sometimes it was then the head of counterterrorism, a man named Brennan, who later became CIA chief for Obama. And sometimes even the president would give briefings, you know, on the phone. And so it was just, they couldn't get enough of it, how wonderful he was, what he did. And it was all not true. Bin Laden was there living. He had chose to hide, escape from us, to go to a resort. What I call the Martha's Vineyard of Islamabad. If it's 105 in Islamabad, in Abbottabad, it's in the foothills above Islamabad, it's 95. So he chose to live there in a villa. He was just there living and nobody knew where he was. And the CIA found out it was a great coup. They did it by interrogations that involved torture. Mm-hmm. That was the key element in the story. Torture produced the names of some couriers that we found, all lies. All eyes, we worked with the ISI, the intelligence agencies of Pakistan, who, by the way, are a major force. I understand Pakistan now has 4 reactors going. Yeah. They pay no attention to it. Anyway, it's up in arms, that country. It's very crazy, very unstable. Anyway, but we don't pay attention to things that are uncomfortable these days. We're more worried about Trump. Trump's back in the news, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
So what they're going to do in their wisdom, they're going to indict Trump for paying off a girl that he slept with, a prostitute, which I would say 20% of the major corporate leaders have done in their life. They're going to indict him for a crime that's going to get him great sympathy, make him more electable. That's what we're going to do right now.
You think he will win again if he's running?
I think the fear of the New York Times and Washington Post and my liberal friends is he will.
Okay.
There's not been one word about my story in the Congress. And the White House has denied the story repeatedly.
Okay.
And I'm telling you, they have more than a little reason to believe the story. I mean, they know I know. There's things I wrote. There's the things I wrote that I could only know from certain ways. So there you are. And the story is certainly gaining traction around the way I hear. I mean, more governments are believing it. And here in your country, and also... people from France, they're paying there's some places in France they're paying 5 times as much for electricity because a lot of the turbines are fueled by natural gas, and the French had closed 2 nuclear reactors because they were menaces. They're going to reopen them, They're not going to produce enough fuel to make up enough energy to make up for the loss of the pipeline, but they'll be a help. In Italy, I speak to reporters. They're paying 3 to 4 times as much for natural gas, and it's only going to go up higher.
Yeah,
it's going to be a real problem for Europe. BASF, your largest chemical company, actually did have some talks in China. They may move some. At least they have stability enough, a guarantee of enough fuel to run their operations. I think they're okay. The big companies are okay, but you read about large bakers in Berlin, bakers that have 12 ovens going down to 4, the people who blow gas, and that's a big industry in Germany. They have to cut off some of their ovens.
Yeah, it's horrible. We have really high prices right now. Inflation is back above 9%, and some businesses even had to close. So let me ask you some critical questions, because you're accusing the New York Times and other publications that they are fed misinformation to disprove your theory. How can you be sure that you are not fed with misinformation? So how reliable is your source, for example?
The story they put out, that was put out by the New York Times.
Yeah.
And then their Zeit picked it up, and they had already been working on the story. And the reporter who wrote the story did say that he'd never had any contact with an intelligence agency. And I certainly, if that's so, I've known him a long time. He used to work for Der Spiegel, and I fixed it. I said, did not work for it. But that doesn't mean the information was clean.
Yeah.
So you're going to do what the CIA did and the other agencies did, run a major operation to blow up 4 pipelines. And the pipelines are steel. This is Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2. They're 2 pipelines each. And they're protected by a concrete shelter. Obviously, you don't have a pipeline sitting in water that's full of salt. Although the Baltic Sea is not nearly as salty as the Atlantic. But it's salty. And, you know, sitting a long time, who knows what can happen. So the concrete, and if you take a photograph of it, it's as tall as a man. And you have to have a charge. That concrete easy to blow up, but the charges you do has to be directed in such a way it blows through the concrete and takes out the pipeline. And they only got 3 of the 4 pipelines. One didn't go off because it was in the water for months, and we don't know why it failed. But guess what country picked up the pipelines, the first to go there and recover the bomb that hadn't gone off? A country called the United States of America. We were there within a day or two and picked it up and took it away, so nobody else could see what kind of evidence there might be with the weapons used. A C4 is a very tricky thing; it's like a chemical plastic and very dangerous. And it was used, and the miners we used were terrific. We had been trained, and we're probably very good. Well, Norway has great sea people. Your country, you're on the water. You have a very good naval operations, and you have your own skill at that. And so I just know an awful lot more ahead than I've written. And I know in real time that the story about a yacht is completely hoax. They found months or two after the operation, and we're talking about the federal police, the DKE, I think they call it.
Yeah.
And the people in Der Zeit absolutely did not talk to your BND. They talked to the federal police, who gave him a tip. And one of them is a good reporter. Maybe he got a tip, but they have been working on the same story at the New York Times. So if you're in Der Zeit and you're working on a story about a yacht that may have dropped and blown up the pipelines, and the German police are saying they did the work on it, they decided after the incident took place, they would go and look for every ship that could have been nearer. And the only problem with that thesis is, of course, any non-commercial ship or yacht that would have been able to do it would not have a directional finder on it, would not have its AIS, its IFF. I mean, if, in case of an emergency, if you're any yacht over 40 feet can go in the ocean, can cross the Atlantic Ocean, go in the Baltic, but you have to be able to tell where, if you're in a danger, you have to have a device that beams that tells you where you are so you can tell rescue people where you are.
Yeah.
The first problem with that story is that they were looking for vessels that had been there, and they found one. And they don't say how they found it, but the only way you could have found it had its beamer on, which is insane.
In Germany, we have some fact checkers, and they say there was no Alter Glass ship which had operated near the blast sites during NATO Baltops maneuver last year. So what's your response to that?
Okay, well, there's something called open source intelligence. The people that do open source intelligence, they're very valuable. They can track down an accident. They know where things are, but they don't see. They use signals. When my president, Biden, flew to via Poland to visit Zelensky about 3 weeks ago on Air Force One, the stories, this I read it either in the Washington Post or New York Times. I didn't think much of it because it's so automatic to me. When they, as part of the protection of the president, when they got into Poland, the Air Force One did something that's very potentially dangerous. They turned off their IFF, their transponder, they call it. Airplanes, as you know, have to beam a signal. So nobody else can get, particularly in bad weather at night. It's a law, but they turned it off because it's Air Force One. What does that do? It makes it invisible. So if you're in a very smart group of intelligence officers who know a great deal about signals traffic, our National Security Agency and the CIA have big units that do that. So you have a situation where you have mines that have been underwater for months. The president has an option of choosing when he wants to do it. He gives you the signal. You then have to send the plane flying not at water level, 200 or so feet at a certain time. It doesn't matter what time. And it has to drop a sonar. And to avoid complications, a low frequency sonar that will beam a signal that 10, 20 minutes will get, by the time it's done, it may take 20 minutes to get to all four of them, which is a boom, go. It's the right beep. I don't know when you were a kid, when I was a teenager, I guess, or 12 or 13, we used to chase girls and they would lock the door. And in order to go, we go knock, 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 knock. That's what they use. It's a very basic signal. They change the pulse. It's like changing a note, playing a flute or something. That's, you change a note. There's a certain, and that the sonar responds to that, which triggers and has the capacity to trigger the bomb on a delay. You do not want to be anywhere near the water when that goes off. You can do a 24 or 48 hour delay is the longest, I think. So you delay it. So by the time the plane that dropped it off, and they don't know what their mission is, and they're not seen because they're not using the transponder, they're already back at a base in Norway. And so if you want to, since ships at sea also use electronic devices, you can recreate any electronic devices you want in the Baltic Sea for those days. And that's the problem with OSINT. They only see signals. And I'm exaggerating, but you could recreate the Japanese armada coming to Hawaii to blow up the American fleet to start World War II there. You can make anything appear there. And the real signal, in case of a problem, the real communication, in case the miners have a problem down there when they're doing the mine, is an American Air Force surveillance plane that also was there. It's in the news. It's in the stories about the president. When the president was in Kiev visiting Zelensky, an American 707 NSA, National Security Agency, it's called a rivet joint plane. They fly over the borders of Russia and China and monitor radar. That plane was diverted. It was over there. It was an emergency link, because the last thing you want to have if you're in the water in the Baltic Sea undercover, you don't want to start broadcasting, you know, emergency, come get me, because somebody will pick up that signal, know there's something going on. You have a special signal, very encrypted, to an airplane above. That was all there. And so it's not a hard explanation. It's just one that the open source people don't like, because what it means is what happens is you use open source as a cover. You don't have the plane ID'd. And whatever ship that was there, they're not seeing because it's not running its AIS, it's running blind. So you can't see it. That's why they couldn't find it. And the other problem with the open source thing from the beginning, when they said there was no plane, no boat there, the question they don't ask is, well, why were there bubbles? Why was it blown up? How did it happen? Because open source can't answer that. They can tell you nobody was there. It couldn't have happened the way I said, because they're not seeing it. But that also doesn't explain why it was bombed. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
But when you're so busy trying to knock down a story as media get to, you know, that's one of the things media like to do. If the story they didn't get, and this kid from left field, you know, outer field, you know, I should use the, I coached soccer here for about 10, 15 years. Nothing like that World Cup game, those passes. Anyway, I can tell you, it was amazing. That one goal with five passes. I mean, I see that in my dreams. Five passes. You know what I'm talking about, the second goal. The most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life. It was like a movie. Anyway, big deal. And so we go. So it's not a hard explanation. They made his plane dark. I can't keep on saying it. And if you get past that, who else could have done it? Do you know how hard it is to go below, and how much training the divers have to do? And I'll tell you something else about it. Only two divers, one for each pipeline, one and two, because they were so good and so skilled. And the trick of an operation like that, of course, you use the Norwegians, and the Alta class boat was there. There's two different. There was a ship called the Alta that people thought I initially was talking about that had burned 2 years earlier, but it was in honor of that ship. They had a next generation. They renamed some of their minesweepers. There's minesweepers and mine hunters in the Norwegian arsenal of sea navy. And one of them has a big bay, and it's big enough that you can put a decompression unit in a recovery unit, you know, so the divers, when they go down, they have to stop. It's 260 feet down. They're wearing masks. They're lightweight stuff, but it's still, you have to be put into it. It's not the steel stuff that you see in the movies where guys go down way deep.
Yeah.
Work. These are relatively lightweight, but they still have to be put in, and somebody has to zip them up and dress them up. And they're breathing oxygen, nitrogen, and helium. It's a mix, and it's 260 feet down. Every 80 or 90 feet, they have to stop a considerable amount of time and get their blood, or so they don't get too much oxygen and die. So it takes time to go down. But if you have a decompression chamber hidden in the Alta class boat, that's not signaling. It's not seen by anybody.
Okay. Yeah. Because this was a second point which was criticized by the fact checkers that according to the videos of the ships, there is no decompression chamber on those ships. But you say they just hide it.
Well, because one of the two ships, there's Alta class has two different kinds of mine. One hunts mines, drops them, and goes hunt them. The other one is a sweeper, picks them up. There's a distinction. One of them had a bigger bay underneath. Yeah.
Okay,
and you could put it into the bay. And I'll tell you what they did. They did fly a special flight, the CIA did, with a decompression chamber. And the idea was to use the Norwegian ships because they're in the Baltic. They understand the sea better than we do. They understand that the Baltic's a very fast-moving current. It clears itself every year. It reinforces. That much water travels. We're talking about 800 miles of water. And they have the usual same tides. So you had to find a place. You have to find a place that. This is my phone, and I don't. I'm not into modern stuff. I don't like Twitter. My children have told me 15 years ago, 20 years ago, you will never tweet and do not Twitter because you will hate what's on it. There's so much crazy stuff, and when I write a good story, there's so much crazy stuff about me on it. So I don't. Yesterday was a lot of stuff on Twitter about the story I did yesterday.
Exactly. Let's talk about the new article on Substack. You just published the cover up. So who did the cover up? What's the story behind it? Because we had, from the New York Times, the German side, we had the article about they found traces of the pro-Ukrainian group who did this all on his little yacht from Rügen out. So what's your theory?
Well, they found, but they haven't found any of the people on it. They got six people identified, and this is your federal police. And you have to have a cover story in case something goes wrong. And what better story is that? There's a yacht. Oh my God! There's a yacht that was the federal police had tracked to. It had been in the area. It was a 1 month rental. From a port, and you know how many ports there are, sail ports in the Baltic Sea. I looked it up, over 200.
Yeah.
But the federal police decided on its own when it happened, we're going to do a search of all the vessels, of all the sailboats. 109 of those are dedicated to sailboats and rentals. You know, you're renting a yacht. You know what I'm talking about? Pleasure in the trip on the Baltic, and The federal, on its own, decided they were going to go and search every port until they found something that looked good. And they found this ship. And it hadn't been rented. They found it in October. And it hadn't been rented. The rental season I ended. And it was just there. And obviously hadn't been cleaned because they found, guess what? They found traces of explosives, some blood, and two passports.
Yeah.
Everybody knows when you go someplace, you leave your passport, whether real or fake. You always leave a fake passport there. I mean, of course you do. So you can give the police some clue to who you might be. I mean, it's not very complicated, not very subtle. And so they found a passport. And so this story was, in all fairness, the fellow that the reporter was, I've known a very competent reporter, was for the Zeit, got a tip about it and was working on it for months, I understand, or just had been reporting on it. But the problem was they couldn't find, the harbor master remembered that six people rented it, but none of the names worked out. They did from the passports, they tracked it to a place in Poland and they did all Ukraine, which led to the story about maybe Ukrainians do it. If you read this article I wrote just yesterday in Substack, I quoted an interview. One of the reporters who wrote the story for the New York Times said, well, we started looking at countries and then we had this great thought. He said, maybe a group in a city did, as if they hadn't been given that thought, but they made it up. And so it was quite silly. In the end, he said, well, we really don't know what's real or not in the story, but they ran it. And then you're der Zeit, you've been working on the story for a long time. Suddenly the New York Times across the water has the same story. Exact, a boat, the same boat, the ship, the same people, this exact same story you've been working on.
Yeah.
So what you do, because that's what newspapers do, you're competitive. You jam your story online. The magazine comes out on Thursday. You run it on Tuesday. Put it out there because you want to match the New York Times. So you're both in the same position. You've done a story that the reporter even acknowledged in his story that it could be a whole fake story. You know, he didn't know, but he knew he had to be one. They've been working on this story, and it was a great story if true. And the New York Times had it without, it seems to me, saying to yourself, how does the New York Times get the same story the federal police in Washington? I mean, in Germany gave me. There's no reason the federal police in Germany would talk to the New York Times to give them that story too. But when you see it in another, the same story, six people they couldn't find, the same boat, explosives, all that stuff, and all this talk about a Ukrainian group, two passports found on a ship. I'm sorry, I've been doing this for a long time, and that stinks. It doesn't make sense. And I think in my wisdom, I probably would have said something, well, maybe we don't want to run into our story right away, because how does the New York Times get the same story we have if we've never talked to anybody, any federal, we've not talked to any intelligence agency, and they had not, which I was clear about when I wrote this. I've corrected it. The reporter got in touch with me and I immediately fixed it. That he said he had no contact. Well, of course he did.
So you said in your new article that it was just a cover-up to get rid of your story about your first article about the Nord Stream attack, and
it was a cover-up. It was designed to mislead people.
Yeah.
It was designed. It had no end. They didn't find a name for anybody. The alleged two divers, and I will tell you. I talked to a friend of mine that knows a lot about diving. Diving off a yacht with heavy equipment down 260 feet you can't even do scuba diving. It'd be hard. You have to be lower to the water. I mean, a yacht's high up diving, unless they could put a skiff down, but that wasn't mentioned. Mm-hmm. Diving, it's in a lot of water. And even with scuba gear, it'd be difficult, but certainly with wearing a heavy uniform, it was a great cover story because it kept everybody in business.
Did the German government contact you anyhow?
No.
So you imply that perhaps the German government and our chancellor was involved in this whole thing?
No. What I say, it's once he's there at a meeting, I was told they discussed pipeline stuff in the meeting. I have no more information than that.
Okay.
And I do go back. Mr. Biden knows what I can do. I mean, there was a time he wanted me to do something for him, but he knows I have competence. I mean, he was in the government. He was in from 72. He was in the Senate and I've been there, and he knows what I can do. And so does Mr. Blinken. They don't like everything I do.
Yeah, I guess so.
And so they had I'm told by somebody who's a great, not a different person, that there was conversation about the pipeline. All I know is that I was absolutely willing to believe when, you know, there was a famous meeting a month of three weeks before the war began, when Schultz and Biden had a news conference, at which time Biden said, well, if they bomb, if they go in, we'll destroy them. And Schultz said nothing, although it would have been very easy for him to say, you know, I fully support the American president, but I really, of course, hope we don't have to do anything as drastic as taking off our means of being warm and rich. You know, we don't want you to take away my means. But he didn't say anything. So I had no idea. At that time, I was asked, did he know? I don't know. The German government has done nothing to tell the truth. They've had their national police be involved in what is absolutely a cover story. There's no way the national police decided they're going to go to every port and look for a ship. I mean, why would you? That's so crazy. Look for a yacht. I mean, you could and so at this point, he's certainly complicit in the notion of trying to keep the secret of who did what. Mm-hmm. He's complicit in that, and that's bad. He shouldn't be doing that. That's not his business is protecting the people of Germany.
Mr. Hirsch, I talked to the former president of the BND, so it's the National Security Service. And he said there's no way that the Americans did it. It has to be the Russians or somebody else. So perhaps a false flag action. What's your take on this?
Are you talking about Mr. Hani?
No, it's Gerhard Schindler, the former president of the BND.
That's consistent with the position of Germany. That's very consistent. Look, it does not make sense for the German chancellor to have willingly agreed to having his job is protecting.
It would be a scandal. It would be a scandal, of course.
But I'm not saying he was witting at any time before, but since this happened, the German government has done nothing to indicate they're seriously interested in naming who did it. There's no way the German federal police decided to go look at every port to find a yacht. That story just doesn't make it. Yeah. And there's no way if you leave a yacht, no matter who you are, do you not clean it? We're talking about a big ship with sleeps 12, five compartments, so I understand. And no way do you not clean it of residue. And no way do you leave, nobody leaves a passport. I mean, this story is such a bad one. I'm long of tooth, so I don't doubt that the one of your heads of the BND, I will tell you they have a tremendously close relationship with us. Yeah. Certainly share information on a lot.
Yes.
Look, you can't get away from one fact. The story that Der Zeit did, the same story was in an American newspaper that it was, and we now know from the interviews that the fellow did, the sort of moronic interview that he did on a podcast. And you know what? I worked for the New York Times. And the New York Times, the way it works now in Washington, the report every day, the Times or every week, they keep a compendium what reporters get on TV to talk about. When I was a reporter there in the 70s on the Vietnam War, I was hired to do the Vietnam War, and I did a lot of critical stuff on the CIA, on Watergate, on corporate crime and stuff like that. I had fun there. I had a great time. Nobody bothered me. They would sometimes call me after I had a good story going, and the public relations office and say, I was in Denver, would you go to an office in Denver for NBC and do an interview for the nightly news? And I would say, are you kidding? Tell them it'll be in the paper tomorrow morning. They can read it tomorrow. It's not the way the world is now. Now you go and you write your story, and maybe two times during the day, you feed the story online where you are. And then you put on makeup and go to five or six television stations, CNN and MSNBC, and then you pimp out the story on television, for which you're getting paid. Probably more money you're getting from the New York Times in total. But that's just, you can't do it if you don't go 10 hours a day or 12 hours a day in a story. You can't do it. You can't do it right. So you have to rely on sources. And since the sources you only have come from the White House on this or for the State Department, you're stuck dealing with the people who are selling you a story.
And what about your source? Did you meet your source in person, or do you know how it is? And is it a reliable source?
I'll say a story about another guy I had. There was another guy I was seeing far, far away from here who had incredible, and he retired. And I used to go to where he was a day before and spend the night in the fanciest hotel, 5-star plus, you know, the kind of hotel. I always go on a Saturday night where Sunday morning, they don't start serving breakfast at 8 in the morning. But it's because it's a ritzy hotel. If you walk in at 6:30, they'll give you coffee and let you sit in the corner. So I used to fly in and I see him the next morning. And we talk until people started coming about 8:30, 9 o'clock. And then we take a walk wherever we were. And one day, after he retired, he said to me one day, we were sitting, standing outside and I guess I had a rental car that was being driven up for me. I was going to go back. I was 200 miles from the airport. I had to be somewhere. And he said to me, you know, I'm so glad I retired because every time I'd go meet you, my wife would say to me, I'm sure at some point, one of these days, you're going to be having breakfast or standing, talk to him and the FBI will come and arrest both of you. I'll never see you again. She said that. So I have a lot of people I talk to and I don't, you're asking me a question I don't like to answer. The one thing I will say to you is that story, the first story I wrote, had nobody in a meeting. So, and I understand I can get criticism. It's the easiest criticism in the world to do, but I had so many sources. As I told you, at the New Yorker, when I worked for the New Yorker, which has very good fact-checking. And by the way, you know what I did? The Substack self-publishing thing, and I have a wonderful editor. I did a lot of writing for the London Review of Books, which you should know is a great magazine. And a terrific editor there is also a great journalist who lives in New York. He hired him to be my editor. And I hired a former fact checker at the New Yorker who knew my people. The fact checkers at the New Yorker are very fussy. They're very famous. This is one of the better ones. Really, I mean, they're all good. This one was terrific. And he's retired and living a good life in upstate New York. And I begged him to come and he's been checking for me. I mean, I'm paying through the nose. And they find things. I mean, they really are very good. They're very good. It's just things you miss. And so I'm doing that because I know anybody in his right mind on the edge like I am with stories. And the fact checker and the person at the London, they know who my people are. Mm. But nobody else does.
Yeah. Did you talk to your source afterwards again?
What are you talking about? Of course.
Yeah. Okay. And would you publish it again after all the backlash? Because you're like a well-reputed journalist, and would you do it again?
Are you asking would I publish Mili again after that? I knew what I will tell you. I did not have a video of American boys murdering and raping, and brutal and physically mutilating mostly women. I didn't know the whole story. You know, I've still under, you know, anybody who got into the Vietnam War as much as I did, we can't, it's still my driving force. I'm still working. I'm still trying to find out some truths about the origin of the war, the containment, Americans' notion of why we did this to contain what, China, communism. It's all very fascinating stuff. So I'm still doing that. That's what I was doing during the COVID. I was going to do a documentary. I've done some stuff on television, stuff like that. I don't like it as much. I mean, I like doing, but of course, you know, the people, here's the thing. There are people in the community, in the military, in the intelligence service, in the State Department. They take an oath of office. And the oath of office they take, and I'm talking about really interesting people, very bright families, maybe of 4 generations in the service, even in intelligence. You know, longtime service to America, to their country. They take an oath of office, not to the colonel or the general or their boss or to the governor or to the president. They take it to the Constitution. And those are the people, believe it or not, that find me. I don't find them. They find me because I'm not afraid. And because I do have ways of checking things. And so that's what it is. I would absolutely write this story again because my government is lying. And I tell you, the founders of our father, Madison, these I don't know if people in Europe read the initial papers of Hamilton. Well, they read Hamilton now because of that wonderful play. But Hamilton was a genius. They were geniuses, the people that decided we're going to have a constitution.
Yeah.
And one of the conversations they had at one point, all arguing about themselves, the idea of having a Congress that's separate and a judiciary that's separate and an executive, and they all three have power. That's sort of the way it is even in your country. There's, but, you know, that's a modern, but that was a very fascinating idea. Of course, it's not so straight now. The executive has more power, so does the court. Congress is a joke. But the idea is they said lying by a president is an impeachable offense. Presidents should not lie. We all lie about things. We lie about, you know, the joke is the fish. I play golf. We lie about, we didn't hit two balls. Bill Clinton used to say he shot good scores because everybody who played with him, he kept on hitting the balls until he got one the way he wanted. You know, if you ever play golf, the shot you screw up, the next shot you hit is always awesome. Perfect. So it's often, you know, you can't change him, but you're tempted to. Anyway, and so he's telling a lie to the American people. And it's a very important. And he stuck with it because he can't admit the lie. And nobody's going to pressure him to, because that's the way the media is today. They're terrified of another Trump. So the New York Times and the liberal New York Times and the liberal Washington Post, more or less, are not going to touch my story ever. And his social programs are great. I just think his foreign policy is madness.
Yeah.
And it'll lead us into a disaster with China. And China, what's China done? China's gone to Shia Iran, implacable enemy of us, and cut a deal with Sunni Saudi Arabia. China buys about 20-25% of its oil, of the Saudi oil. It's going to start paying in yen, not dollars.
Yeah.
And what does Iran do? All of a sudden, the Houthis in Yemen, who are fighting a war, stop. So you get a settlement in Yemen. You get Iran being tucked under the coverage of Saudi Arabia, which makes it much harder for Israel, which has gone nuts. And my president's not saying much about that now. I mean, that is really crazy what's going on there. You have a man that's doing all of this damage so he doesn't go to jail. You know, I mean, it's just quite insane. And we don't deal with it in America. And so it's a whole new world.
It's a paradigm shift, definitely. We see the end of Pax Americana, I guess.
Hooray! Hooray! What did we do?
Yeah.
What did we do in Afghanistan? What did we do in Iraq?
Yeah.
I mean, who are we to claim some sort of, you know, blessed, no, you know, rules ordered? That's what the Secretary of State said. Well, you got me going.
Yeah.
But I don't do this because of politics. I do it because the story came to me. And
yeah.
By the way, I nobody brings it to me. I ask somebody a question. It just was on my mind one day. I got to go. You see, I'm getting 18 calls.
All right. Mr. Hirsch.
I'm not going to turn off my phone unless I throw it against the wall. And I've done that enough, so it's half broken anyway. I'm a Luddite. You know what a Luddite was? Luddite in the ancient days?
No.
When they began to get machinery, the wheel and all that. The Luddites were the one who were in Europe, were against any progress.
Last question. Did other whistleblowers contact you after your article? And are you working on something else? Can we expect another bombshell?
No, I have a bunch of stories I can write.
All right. We're looking forward, and I hope to talk to you again. Thank you very much for your work. A lot of respect, and thanks for your time.
And thank you. I don't know. You get me going. That's great.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's not hard to get me going. You know, this is what I do for a living.
Thank you. I'm honored.
I'm sure it's somebody that's got a crew outside my house. It's crazy things happen. What I get is people knock on my door. Whistleblowers. I'm serious.
Yeah, I guess so. That's why. What I think.
I met somebody the other day out of one of the army services, military services. And I said, whoa, you can't just come knocking on my door. First of all, I have an office downtown that I don't like as much. I'm working at home now, and I like it much more. You know, my children are grown. I've got a big old house. I got a nice room. My wife's the doc, and she goes to her office. And so I can do what I want all day, you know, take a nap, go hit some golf balls, whatever I want.
I'll talk to a German guy. Hope to talk to you soon again, Mr. Hirsch. It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well.
Take care. Take care. Thank you. Bye.